Hello again and welcome to A Sporting Discussion, your podcast talking sports of all sorts. I'm AJ Mithen, back here for another week with my wonderful co-host Andrew Donison. Andrew, welcome.
Yes, it is an absolute pleasure to be here. We've got a little bit more sport that has been played. The Bundesliga is back. It joins the K-League, the Korean top flight soccer league, which came back 2 weeks ago. It hasn't followed the lead of the K-League and put, high-class sex dolls in the crowd like the K-League did.
Yeah, interesting one, that one, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Certainly one way to put a fake crowd in.
So what they were going to do was offer people the opportunity to purchase a virtual seat. And what that would be is you would pay X number of dollars, send a photo of yourself, and you would then be put in the crowd for the broadcast. I think that's genius.
I like that. That's a little different to high-class sex dolls.
Yeah.
One's a little more family-friendly.
They didn't realise what they were doing. They were just like, oh, we just thought that they were, mannequins.
Sure. Okay.
Yes.
But we're not here to talk sex dolls, Andrew. We have a theme this week.
No, that's our other podcast.
Yes.
What is our theme for this week, AJ? Get me out.
I was hoping you'd bail me out of that. Anyway, this week is unappreciated champions.
Now, yes.
Unappreciated champions, as in not people who have a one-off appearance, a one-off,
not
big
like
day on a grand final or something like that, or a role player who was, best team man, best teammate or something like that, or clubhouse favourite or something like that. We don't want that.
Best club person for 1997 to 2005.
We wanted rolled gold, five-star, world-leading champion superstar players who don't get the regard that they so sorely deserve. And we put it out on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/asportingdiscussion. In the forum we've got there, we put it on ASD at ASD underscore radio on Twitter. And we got flooded, Andrew. We got a whole bunch of suggestions from people who appreciated the chance to be able to give a bit of shine to some out-and-out champions who may have fallen by the wayside.
Yeah, it was great to see the range of sports that were involved as well. And when some of the people, you just go, oh, yeah. And obviously some of the ones that we're going to mention as well, we'll get some people just going, well, they're not unappreciated.
Mm.
We're more talking about in the general populace, not just, we know that certain people are going to understand and know exactly what one person has done. But in general, you go, well, what about Ian Bishop? Everyone talks about Curtly Ambrose and Courtney Walsh, but Ian Bishop was a part of that attack for a long time. You talk about
Malcolm Marshall, if we're talking West Indies. I nearly said West Coast. West Indies. Malcolm Marshall was a gun. He was a huge part of the attack, but he's gone by the wayside with Joel Garner on that, like you just said. There's a lot of absolute champions out there who have either been in the shadow of bigger champions like Scottie Pippen with Michael Jordan, just to be topical, or Matthew Dellavedova with LeBron James, Andrew.
Sure.
Yeah. No, we're not talking Dellies. This is a no Delhi zone. No,
exactly.
No teammates, no hustle. No, we love your effort. We love your energy. We want absolute five-star roll gold sporting champions.
So I'm gonna throw a couple out, and one of them is the one that started us on this journey, and that is one SCG McGill. Stuart McGill, there was an article in the paper last week where he was talking about when Shane Warne retired, he thought, oh, excellent, and he set himself a goal to take 400 test wickets. Now, that didn't happen. Whole range of injuries befell him in his attempted taking over the mantle. But Prior to that, he had 198 test wickets. He finished with 208 test wickets at an average of 29. He had 12 five-wicket innings, two 10-wicket matches, and a best bowling of an innings of 8 for 108. Stuart McGill, and people often go, oh, in any other era. No, not in any other era. In this era, he's the 16th highest wicket taker for Australia in test matches.
The what?
16th highest of all time.
Wow. And how many tests did he play? Sorry?
He played 44 test matches.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. 101 shy of Shane Warne's.
Mm. Well, that's perfect. Yeah. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah. So he, amazing, amazing cricketer. I would say misunderstood human. I thought that he was...
Yeah, he was known for being quite intense, wasn't he?
Yes. And then myself and a few friends met him and the rest of the New South Wales team in a pub down in Tasmania one evening, and I cannot speak highly enough of Stuart McGill.
Did he recommend some good wines, being a sommelier?
At that point of the night, no, he did not.
I would have thought anything he recommended would have been great.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got another one, and it's cricket, and it's a similar era.
Mm.
When people think of the Australian bowling attack from the golden years, it's McGrath, Lee, and Warne. They're the three that get thrown out there. What about the bloke that took the 8th most test wickets for Australia, Jason Gillespie?
Oh, that's a good one too.
259 wickets at 26.14. He went at 2.85 runs and over. They just could not get him away. He was injured for a significant portion of a large portion of his playing career, therefore only played the 71 test matches. But when he was there, he was absolutely brilliant. His off-cutter was magnificent. But everyone, Brett Lee and Glenn McGrath. Glenn McGrath, fair enough. No doubt. Brett Lee, sure. But, geez, Jason Gillespie was a good cricketer.
He was fantastic, wasn't he?
He was. Can I go one more cricketer from before I hand over to you for a couple of yours?
Yeah, okay, go for it.
And this is a guy who, bizarrely, has scored 11,867 test match runs at an average of 51.37, and yet still is completely unappreciated. He's the 8th highest run scorer. He is the second highest run scorer
ever in cricket?
Ever in test match cricket.
Okay.
He's the second highest West Indian run scorer in test match cricket.
Mm.
Shivnarine Chanderpaul.
Oh, that's a ripper.
Yeah, just 21 years he played for, 164 tests, 11,867 runs, at an average of 51.37, 30 centuries.
I had no idea he'd scored that many runs.
Yep.
Wow, yep. That's the clubhouse leader for the most unappreciated champion at the moment.
I'll read through the list of top run scorers.
Yeah.
Tendulkar, Ponting, Callis, Dravid, Cook, Sangakkara, Lara, Chanderpaul, Jai Wardener, Border, and then you've got Waugh and Gavaskar.
Wow.
So pretty, pretty lofty company.
Actually, just you reading that out, Alistair Cook's a sneaky one we could add to this list today, but we're not going to. We have our time.
12,500 runs. Yeah. Yep.
Sneaky. All right.
So there's a couple from me. So as we said, it started when Stuart McGill was in the press, and I'm like, I wonder how many test wickets he took. And I was surprised.
Barring injury, he could have doubled that and gone on. Mm. Wouldn't have done much with the bat, but hey, there you go.
He won a Sheffield Shield final with the bat.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Oh, geez, he did it all, didn't he?
I know. So give me a couple of yours, AJ.
All right, I'll give you my first one. It's another cricket one.
Okay.
And he's from India, former opening quick Javagal Shunath. Now, if ever there is a horrible job in cricket, it is being a fast bowler opening in home test matches in India, where you are basically there just to take shine off the ball for guys like Harbhajan Singh, Anil Kumble, and the spin crew that have been in and out of the Indian side over the decades. But Javagar Srinath opened the bowling all the time. 67 tests. Where am I? 67
tests. 236 wickets.
236 wickets at an average of 30. Now, just over 30. And his best, 8 for 86. Now, you tell me, he took 5 wickets 10 times and he bowled in 121 innings. So every 10 innings, he took 5 wickets.
It's not bad.
Every 12 or so innings. Yeah, my maths isn't fantastic, but it's still bloody good.
It's very good.
For a fast bowler on absolute dust bowls that have been rigged for spin over in India for how long did he play for? 20-odd years.
So it's, I remember,
incredible. I loved him when he was playing, and I love him even more having seen how hard it is for people, now that I understand more about playing cricket in India, and how hard it is for people to do well over there. He was a phenomenal player.
He was. So, 1991 to 2002, so 12 years he played for. And if you look at his bowling average at home, it was 108 wickets at 26.61.
That's phenomenal.
And away, it was 128 at 33.77. He had a better average on those dead lifeless pitches. Now, and this is, Zahir Khan has more test wickets. I think Ishant Sharma has more test wickets. But Javagar Srinath was playing at a time where we watched a game where Sourav Ganguly opened the bowling with Srinath, bowled 4 overs, and then they brought the spinners on.
Mm.
So Ganguly was just there because they didn't want to go against convention and bowl a spinner.
Yeah.
From the first opening bowling. But Srinath was just toiling away at the other end. That's a really good
one. I loved him. I thought he was a fantastic bowler.
Yeah. And a quarter of his overs couldn't bat to save
himself, but that didn't matter either. That was quite funny.
A quarter of his overs were maidens over at home as well. So, very good nomination.
All right. Before I go on my next one, we got, like I said, truckloads of people suggesting stuff through at ASD Radio on Twitter and facebook.com/thesportingdiscussion. I'll give you a couple of Twitter ones, Andrew.
All right. Far away.
Nick Henning got in touch with us again, the author working on the Balmain book. Come on, Nick. Yep. We want to read that book. He says, I've been thinking about this, and for me it has to be Elisa Camplin.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Was she the ski jump? Is that
you're really testing my knowledge of Winter Olympics. Definitely, it was.
Oh man,
it was definitely. She was the first. No, she wasn't the first skier to win gold. She was at consecutive Winter Olympics, she was the first Australian skier to medal.
Aerial skier. That's what they call it. Aerial skier, to ski jump. Come on. That was Eddie the Eagle. Well, anyway, back to what Nick said. She didn't win her gold medal because all the other competitors got tangled up and fell over. She won with pure skill. Yeah, she was the first one to win after Steve Bradbury. Plus, she's an awesome Aussie. There should be a bio based on her life. And Nick also suggested another Olympian, a summer Olympian this time, Chloe Esposito, the Rio 2016 gold medalist in modern pentathlon.
Yes.
Nick says, modern pentathlon requires so many skills and her gold medal at Rio was incredible. And while swimming, was getting so much funding, she found her own way. That's right. She had to do her own training and battle away in the background. And she's going to have a baby now. So she's out of the next Olympics.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, everyone might be out of the next Olympics, depending on how the world goes. But yeah,
that's great. Two great ones from Nick, Elisa Camplin and Chloe Esposito.
That's brilliant. And Chloe Esposito's father competed at the 1984 Olympics.
That's right.
And her brother was also at the 2016 Olympics. Father and brother were in what's the pentathlon?
Modern pentathlon. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, which ranges things from long jump, 400-meter sprint, to fencing, to horse riding, to, yes.
Amazing.
You've got to cover everything.
I'll jump back to Elisa Camplin. So gold medal 2002 in Salt Lake City, bronze at 2006 in Turin. She also won gold at the World Championships in 2003. I will take Nick up on the didn't just fall over. We've done a bit of a... an in-depth look at Stephen Bradbury.
Yeah, we've covered that before. That was actually a strategy to hold back and wait it flat for everyone to fall over. Yes,
but he had been favourite for that two Winter Olympics prior, and he almost died on the ice twice. But
that's true.
Looking at Alyssa Camplin, she broke her collarbone, she broke her hand, she had a separated shoulder, she broke two ankles, she tore her Achilles tendon, she tore her ACL, and had 9 concussions.
Yeah, the aerial skiing's not for everyone, is it?
No, definitely not for you or I.
No, I'd probably be, yeah, I wouldn't have made it.
No.
I would have hurt myself, yes, quite badly.
Yeah, awesome nominations there for unappreciated champions, genuine champions, gold medal winners.
Now, it's funny, Andrew, on the Twitter we've got some more cricket ones. I'll get through these ones pretty quickly because we don't want to delve into stats and all of that sort of stuff. Jamie Stripe has suggested Nasser Hussain, former English captain. He says dragged English cricket off its ass. Casso says, honest to God, David Boone, so well known for beer stories and other things like Warney's hat-trick catch that people forget and don't know how good he was. 100-plus tests, average in the mid-40s against the 80s and 90s West Indies with long boundaries, made 20-odd centuries. Casso, that's a good one. And last cricket one until we hit the Facebook comments, David Pearce, who has put forward former England all-rounder Tony Gregg, says, as a player and captain, he was absolutely top draw with 3,000 runs at 40 and well over 100 wickets at 30. I'll take your word for that, David. A better all-rounder than any who followed apart from Botham, and he was vilified and airbrushed because of Packer. He's definitely a forgotten gun. That's a rip. 3 rippers. Two poms.
Yeah, I know. Tony Gregg, if you talk to people who saw him play, they absolutely rate him as one of the very best that's played the game. So 141 wickets at 32, 3,600 runs at 40.
One of the first players to wear a helmet with a face guard.
Yeah.
Yes. The old
soft and stupid.
They used to wear those massive like plexiglass things like what you see at the supermarket these days, like a sneeze guard on the salad bar. That used to be the face guard on the cricket helmets. Anyway, but we'll move on. I said we got lots of these things. Our good mate, former our regular guest, co-host a couple of weeks ago, Aaron Della Hunty from the Guardian Gun Netball Sports Journo, said, shall I just send over a list of every Aussie Diamonds player ever? That's the Aussie Netball team. We'll take that.
Yep. Not a bad shout at all.
Yeah, I thought we'd get a bit more AFL and NRL players than we did, Andrew. You know, hey, whatever. It's a world. Yeah. This is a worldwide thing, so it was good. We got a lot of worldwide stuff. Andrew McDougall said Chris Grant and Doug Hawkins, former Footscray Bulldogs players in the AFL. Chris Grant should have won a Brownlow, but didn't get it. No, he was. Chris Grant was fantastic.
No. Player. I think this might be one of those ones that I was talking about before, where maybe the general populace doesn't, but I would think that Chris Grant is renowned or is held in high regard for, but maybe not across the
spectrum, not with millennials. Let's use that as our guide. And Doug Hawkins was, thanks to the AFL Footy Show, was basically portrayed as a joker of a clown, but he was actually quite a bloody good player who broke the games record for the Footscray Western Bulldogs now, and has a wing named after him at their home ground.
Was one of the best wingmen in the game when that was a genuine position that people played.
Yeah.
He started on the wing and just ran all day up and down. Yeah, he was a brilliant footballer.
Yeah, and we had another Aussie rules suggestion from Xavier Player, who said, Sadi Ghazi. I expect that's relatively tongue-in-cheek, Xavier, thank you. I actually played against Sadi Ghazi, Andrew, back in the day.
Really?
Yeah, back in the day.
Sadi Ghazi played, was it Williamstown or Werribee?
Williamstown.
Yeah. Number 27, with the long hair.
He's a club legend at Williamstown in the VFL, the Victorian Football League, in Victoria.
We got one, and I'm going to defer to you to the man who has the notes for the person who sent this in. But it was Hawthorn centre-half back Chris Mew.
Ah, yes, that was from David Thomas.
David Thomas. Yeah, he was basically, Chris Mew was one of the first ones that I thought of as well. Like Alan Jeans always said he was the first first player selected in the team. He's in the five-time premiership player, centre half back in the Hawthorn, what do they call it, team of the century. So amongst Hawthorn supporters, and the club's certainly not unappreciated, but I think in the wider sporting, wider football community, people didn't necessarily see him as as much of a brilliant footballer as we, or as a Hawthorn supporter. Yeah.
You could say we there are.
No, I didn't want to say we as in you and I. But
and oh no, definitely not me. I love Chris Mube for the rhyming slang he ended up becoming. David, just because I've got the notes, I'll read David's entry. It says, Chris Mube played in five VFL premierships with Hawthorn in the 80s and 90s. Dermy, Dunstall, Dipper, Ayres, even Langford got all the accolades. Yet Mew was the centre half back in the Hawks team of the century.
Yep, and everyone says it's one of the more difficult positions to play. You're always playing on the opposition's gun forward. So
and an absolutely glorious, glorious moustache. Now, while I'm here in the notes, Andrew, I'll go through a few more of the suggestions we had.
Far away,
Matt Shields through Facebook recommended Clive Lloyd, former West Indian captain. He says,
"Yes,
Viv Bryan and all the pacemen get all the West Indies plaudits, but it was the Super Cat that started it all. Wisden's Cricketer of the Year and rescued his team in the 1975 World Cup final. I don't know how old Matt is, but I'll take your word for that."
Go on. 7,500 runs in Test matches at an average of 46. Not too shabby.
My personal favourite, wore glasses, batted without a helmet.
Yeah,
because he didn't need to. Just a gun.
Yeah, well, he was that good. 110 Test matches, 87 One Day Internationals as well.
Yeah, because that's right. He would have been part of the first ever One Day International, wouldn't he? Anyway. Matt gave us another one. Michelle Timms, former Aussie basketballer. Criminally underrated, first Aussie basketballer to play professionally overseas. I think she played for the Phoenix Mercury in the WNBA, Michelle Timms, as well as her career here in the WNBL and for the Australian women's team. She's, absolute legend of the sport, now in coaching.
Yeah, phenomenal, phenomenal basketballer. And 164 centimetres, so not tall.
I believe that classifies as pocket rocket.
We can go with... I would have said that Christy Harrower was the pocket rocket.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, Christy Harrower, pocket rocket.
Whereas, Michelle Tim, so she played for Tachiki 18 years, 5 years for the Phoenix Mercury, was a WNBA All-Star in 1999.
In the early days of that league as well. She was one of the trailblazers.
Yes, she was also the Women's International Player of the Year in 1994 and 96, and was in the WNBL All Team seven times.
Not bad, huh?
pretty good, and just forgotten to a certain extent. Now, this might be, as we said and Aaron was alluding to before with the Diamonds, this might be a women in sport thing. This might be an Australian, recognising their basketballers. Lauren Jackson is one of the very best basketballers that has ever played the game and should at the moment be considered Australia's greatest basketballer, was the number one draft pick in the WNBA, four-time WNBL MVP, four-time WNBL Grand Final MVP, seven-time WNBA All-Star, three-time WNBA MVP, two WNBA champions, three WNBA scoring champions. She was the finals MVP in one of the winning years as well. So 2010, she was the WNBA MVP and the finals MVP in a championship side. And I just don't think that she gets anywhere near the accolades that she deserves.
I don't know about that. I think she's probably... Lauren Jackson's probably just a level above what we're talking about here because she is well known and celebrated around the Australian basketball community, and her name does come up quite a bit when people are talking about Australia's best sporting exports. So I'm going to say
veto that one.
I'm going to veto that one.
All right.
She's too good. She's too well known for this one.
All right. Next one, number 11 draft pick in the 2001 WNBA draft, Penny Taylor.
Yeah.
Penny Taylor, she won tournament MVP at the World Championships when Australia won the gold medal in the World Championships in 2006. So she won that ahead of Lauren Jackson. She's represented Australia a significant number amount of times. She's a three-time WNBA champion, a three-time WNBA All-Star, and, yeah, just one of the absolute best in the world, but severely underappreciated in Australia.
Yeah, that's true. Let me get through a couple more of the Facebook ones.
All right.
Miloslav Mechia, the best tennis player never to win a major. That's from Tim Dodgson. Mechia won an Olympic gold medal, but he never won a major. I remember he had a beard. A nice red beard.
I'll accept that because I had never heard of them before Tim raised that.
Really?
Yep.
No, he did all right. I think he was runner-up in the Aussie Open once. But anyway, let's move on. Scotty James was suggested by Damien Telford. Scotty James, the Aussie snowboarder.
Snowboarder, yeah.
Flag bearer of the 2018 Winter Olympics.
Yes.
Who else have we got? We've had a couple of rippers there. Oh, here it is. Brad Waters has suggested Brad Thorne, who played rugby league and rugby union. Now, Brad Waters says of Brad Thorne, is he the greatest ever footy dual international? Not only did he win three NRL titles, two State of Origin series, a Super Rugby title, a Rugby World Cup and a Heineken Cup, he did it while often swapping to and fro between the codes and as a forward rather than a back, which is regarded as a far trickier transition. Now, that's a really good one because Brad Thorne won a Rugby World Cup with New Zealand, won a Heineken Cup over in Europe. I can't remember which team it was. A Super Rugby title with the Crusaders, two State of Origin series with Queensland, and three NRL titles with the Broncos. Now, it's interesting about that because you'll notice in all of that, there's Brisbane for the NRL. That's great. There's New Zealand as his national team. And for some reason, he also played for Queensland in the NRL State of Origin because their eligibility criteria were tweaked just enough so that he could play for Queensland if he wanted to.
Of course.
That's a great call from Brad Waters. Brad Thorne was an absolute champion and disappeared into everything with the Burgesses and all of that, getting all the hype these days.
Yeah, so 22 years he played, and it wasn't just played rugby league and then went to play union. He played rugby league for 7 years, then he played union for 4 years, then he played league for 3 years, then he played union for 8 years.
Yeah, so just incredible.
Is he the one who would wear that neck brace?
No, that was Brent Tate.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, he was in the centres.
Right. Yeah. Right, good. Brad Thorne definitely underappreciated. And the just 200 games for the Broncos and then went and played 171 games across a number of teams in rugby union, plus his representative team. So he played over 250 games, close to 250 games in each. Phenomenal. Yeah,
just amazing.
Just outrageous.
Another one from Sam Ward, who a lot of cricket here, who suggests Dale Steyn, South African fast bowler. Sam says, stats show that Dale Steyn is the best fast bowler of all time, but he never gets that kind of recognition. It's hard to disagree with the second part of that sentence. Andrew, do you have any idea of the first one? Do the stats show that Dale Steyn is the best fast bowler of all time?
No, but it depends. So I have a bracket of the 64 top fast bowlers, best fast bowlers.
Of course you do.
And I'm trying to find an appropriate website to host it on. But what I based it on was I ranked all of the bowlers in terms of wickets, maidens, average, 5 wicket innings, 10 wicket innings, blah, 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 economy rate, strike rate, all of those. And gave people a ranking, and then they got their overall ranking, and then person that came out number one in that was Malcolm Marshall.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Hey, you know, if you're looking for a website that you want to put that on. How about the brand new spanky looking sportingdiscussion.com.au? We can handle a bracket with an asterisk.
Yes. All right. I'll try and figure out how to do it.
Let's talk offline. Yeah. Let's take that offline, Andrew.
Take that offline. But Dale Steyn, I think he is number 8 of all time in wickets taken in Test matches.
Mm.
And is a brilliant bowler. I read a really good article. He must have been on doing a podcast with someone. He actually came out and talked about how great Jimmy Anderson is and how, you know, he's a genuine swing bowler, whereas Dale Steyn he's just going, I just try to make it just difficult for,
blast it
for
past the
batsman. I just bowl fast, I bowl, make them play. And look, Dale Steyn, at his best, he was able to swing the ball both ways. He could move the ball off the deck. But, yeah, 439 wickets at an average of 22.95.
Oof, wow.
It is, yeah, just
that's
amazing. So
that's a champion.
Of all time.
That's an absolute champion. Yeah.
Yeah. And all right. You know what? Jimmy Anderson, screw you all your people who call him underrated. And, oh, no, he only performs
in England,
home. You can't perform away. Yeah. So if you look at the ratio of bowling average at home compared to bowling average away of the top 10 bowlers, it's not the worst. He's not the second worst. He's not the third worst. He's the fourth worst behind Mathai Muralitharan, Anil Kumble, Rangana Harath.
Wow.
So, yeah, and then only just behind Kapil Dev and... Yeah, who's got, yeah. So he has a better record away at home than he does away, but he's not the only one.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme.
He's taken 584 wickets.
That's insane.
He's the fourth highest of all time.
Yeah.
Get out of it, Anderson haters.
All right, I'm going to bring another one of mine in.
All right.
And this is one of my favourite combat fighters, combat athletes, whatever you want to call them. And it's John Wayne Parr, the gunslinger, JWP, who recently retired Anthony Mundine in a straight-up boxing fight. Now, what people don't know about John Wayne Parr is that he is
I'll jump in there, and what I don't know is that he was a boxer, so or that he existed. So thank you.
All right. Well, that's perfect.
Now,
perfect
what
for
else,
this show.
What else don't I know about John Wayne Parr?
John Wayne Parr started as a kickboxer or a Muay Thai fighter. Pardon me, The Art of Eight Limbs. And he went over to Thailand when he was 17 to train over there and learn Muay Thai and kickboxing and stand-up boxing on the thing. Now, his kickboxing record is at 132 fights. He's won 99 of them, 46 of them by knockouts, and he's lost 33. His professional boxing record, he only had 14 fights, but he won 11 of them and 10 of those by knockout, and he lost 3. And one of those losses was going the distance against Sakio Bika, who is a former world champion challenger. So John Wayne Parr is an absolute legend in the combat game. He went training over in Pattaya and Bangkok, fought some of the most famous Thai fighters in one of the most famous stadiums in the fight game, Lumpini Stadium over in Thailand, where they get 100,000 people watching the fights.
Right.
And when they have the Thai King's birthday, they have a massive tournament there, and he won that tournament and has been best fighter, voted best fighter, which is unheard of for a white fella, putting it bluntly. And so he came back to Australia. He's recently started up he retired after the Mundine fight, but he started up an MMA gloves, like Muay Thai, in an octagon competition. But he's won, he has won world championships in kickboxing, Muay Thai. He's four-time world kickboxing champion. 8-time world kickboxing champion, four-time, five-time world Muay Thai champion, runner-up in the Contender Asia, which was, you remember the Contender boxing show?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They did a Muay Thai, a kickboxing version of that, and he came second. He's an absolute champion who has been around for decades and decades, and he was actually middleweight champion in 2001 for boxing. So it's a hell of a career, and there's a documentary.
Across multiple
Multiple disciplines.
Sports as well.
Yeah, he had three fights with Yod Sang Klai, who's he's an icon over in Thailand when they talk about sport. And they had three classic fights over the course of their careers. And there's a documentary out about him called Blessed with Venom. And luckily for us, it's free on YouTube. So I'm going to put the link to that in. I'm going to write this up and put it on our website and put the link to that in there as well. John Wayne Parr, another one of mine. Yeah. I think he's an absolute legend and champion fighter that no one knows about.
I certainly don't. I'll throw one out, and I think we might have actually also got this on the Facebook. Someone who, if you talk to people outside of Australia, would say absolutely he's a brilliant at his sport. Mark Viduka.
Yeah, suggested by Mike Tuckerman on Facebook. Yeah.
Yes. Sure, he didn't perform it as – how to put this – he didn't perform as people anticipated he would for Australia compared to his non-Australian playing. However, that was, I think, due to the fact that people didn't realise just how much better than everyone else he was when he was playing for Australia. There were so many times where – he was, like, back to goal, had the ball at his feet, holding off two and three defenders, just looking around for someone, anyone to pass the ball to, and there's just no one getting into the right spot. Whereas when he played in the Premier League, when he was at Leeds, Middlesbrough, Newcastle, he was playing in a structure that much more suited his game style.
Mm.
But for
his role with the Socceroos was pretty different, wasn't it? It was basically holding it up for the guys like Kuehl and Bresciano and that to come flying past and do something with it, whereas, yes, he was just allowed to be an out-and-out striker for his club sides. He was an absolute champion, Mark Viduka.
Yeah, so
Mike's comment says, I don't think Australians ever really understood the genius of Mark Viduka, a bona fide world-class talent who only showed his best on the club rather than international stage. And I think the point Mike's making is a bona fide world-class talent, because outside of Australia, Viduka was godlike when he played for Celtic and when he played for Middlesbrough and when he played for Leeds. He was in the top five, maybe top 10, of football players in the world.
Yeah, he averaged half a goal per appearance at club level, but only 0.25 a goal per game for Australia. So he was twice as effective in club football. And as you say, he was holding the ball up and just trying to pop it into space for Bresciano to run onto and have a crack from 30 metres out and just either death or glory it. But if he could have, but that was because of the way that the team was structured. If we had another Viduka to play that role, then he could have actually played as the genuine striker, and Australian fans would have just gone, yeah, geez, you are pretty good at this game.
Now, we got a few more football ones. One of them's mine, so I'm going to pull rank and go first. And
okay.
It's Lucas Neal, former Socceroos captain, former Socceroos defender.
Why did he go to ground? Why?
Well, he went to ground because he was accused, by SBS's The World Game of being the driving force behind a 2010 alleged dressing room mutiny against coach Pim Verbeek at the 2010 World Cup when Australia was playing Germany. You remember that first game against Germany where Verbeek changed the lineup and basically went to park the bus, and there were rumours coming out that Lucas Neal had led a players' revolt saying, we're not going to do this, you're kidding. He actually came out and said, no, that's not true. And SBS and Les Murray apologised to him, saying, yes, okay, we got it wrong. But Neil, the reason why Neil has copped it so much from Aussie fans is very few people realise that he's a defender, centre-back and a fullback. He's an absolutely sensational player, arguably, well, not arguably, in my eyes, Australia's best player at that phenomenal 2006 World Cup that we all look back on so fondly. 96 games for Australia.
And allow Grosso to dive. Stay in his feet. Keep your feet, Lucas.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Oh, Grosso dived.
I know.
What? Why a lot of people in Australia went off him was there was a time when he was the most highly sought after. In late 2000s, 2007, let's call it, he was the most highly sought after defender in football. He had money absolutely thrown at him from Liverpool. He had Barcelona trying to get him as well, and he had West Ham offering him money as well. He ended up taking West Ham's money, which was £160,000 per week to play. You tell me you're not going to take that. Get bent. I know you're lying.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm just having a look. Sorry, Blackburn Rovers. Yes, I've played with you for 6 years, but 160K a week.
Yeah.
I'm taking that every day of the week. I remember a time in the – must have been when he was at Millwall when he was – there was a bookie who was taking odds on which Australian was the next to be sent off.
Yeah.
Because I'm pretty sure that was Kevin Muscat playing over in the
Muscat and Cahill were both playing for Millwall. Yeah,
right.
Maybe it was a bit early for Cahill.
No, yeah. So yeah, this would have been when he was when Muscat was either at Crystal Palace or Wolves.
All right, yeah.
And yeah, he. So apparently, there was a time around then that Lucas Neal and Muscat were just hacking players left, right, and centre so much that bookies were just going, righto, which one's going to get sent off next?
Yeah, that was part of the character of playing for Millwall playing with Kevin Muscat. Lucas Neal is an absolutely sensational player. He was. He played hundreds and hundreds of games in the toughest leagues in England, and then he went over and played in Turkey. But a lot of the problems with soccer is from that 2006 golden era was he came out here to play for Sydney FC,
yep,
and then was hurt and then couldn't do much, and everyone was kind of like, oh, well, you're rubbish. What are you doing out here? And you know, same sort of thing that happened to John Aloisi and Vince Grella when they came back here to play. People were just basically assholes to them, thinking that they were this is, you know, half a decade, almost a decade post 2006, and people are still expecting them to come out and perform exactly like they did in the absolute cauldron, in their absolute athletic prime, in the highest standard of competition in world football. It's just not happening. So, and then all this other stuff happened where people were, yeah, he became public enemy number one, and then he went to ground.
Yeah, no. So yeah, my going to ground was in relation to the.
I know.
Your going to ground. Is, yeah, in relation to.
Actually, going to ground.
Yeah, go. Now I'm surprised, AJ, that you haven't brought up a person that I thought that you might. Now I'm just going to quickly find the person who nominated.
Well, sorry, go on.
This one.
Yep.
So Jeremy Friedman got in contact with me and mentioned someone. They played 837 games in the major league, in American Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
105 home runs, a .284 career batting average. Played for 8 years with the Milwaukee Brewers.
Oh, Dave Nielsen.
Dave Nielsen.
Yeah, we should have had Dave Nielsen.
I'm flabbergasted. My gast is flabbered that he was not one of the first people that you brought up.
Yeah, that's a big oversight by me.
Yes.
Dave Nielsen is one of Australia. Well, he is Australia's best ever baseballer, export
Graham
or
Lloyd?
Not. Oh, yeah, no, not Graham Lloyd.
Yeah.
Dave Nielsen all the way. Yep.
Yep.
He was an all-star, didn't win any championships. Graham Lloyd won championships because he was lucky enough to be on the Yankees. But Nilsson walked away from Major League Baseball in his prime to represent Australia at the Olympics, and never went.
2000 Olympics,
and never went back.
Mm.
Had people chasing him all over the place, and never went back. Now he's the manager of the Brisbane Bandits, who won four straight Australian Baseball League titles, and he's also the coach of the Australian team, who are trying to qualify for the Olympics.
And you did not even mention him, AJ.
I'm absolutely disgusted with myself, Andrew.
If you're disgusted, imagine what I am.
Laughing.
All right, let's...
We're going to hang on a couple. We'll rip through a couple more.
All right.
And then I'll do my last one. Andrew Prentice on Facebook suggested this one's an absolute beauty. John Filan, a former Aussie goalkeeper, is a brilliant goalkeeper in the 90s. He had a long career in England with Wigan and Blackburn Rovers and was in the 1992 Olympic team, which made the semi-finals. His problem was that he was around the same era as Bosnich and Schwarzer, who got most of the attention, but Filan was just as good. I remember John Filan was an absolute champion playing through the... He played in the English Premier League for a long, long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another one that I'm not aware of.
Mm. Oh, I remember John Filan, yeah. And... Let's say last one here, because we're running out of time. Stuart Thomas has squeezed quite a few in here, so bear with me. Jack Brabham's achievements before any other Australian ever threatened to succeed in Formula One are often forgotten.
Yes, definitely.
You could probably also suggest that Mick Doohan is something of a forgotten man, former, now it's MotoGP. He was 500cc world champion.
Five-time?
Yep.
Five-time champion?
David Graham, he took over from Wayne Gardner.
And
then he was the next one. Yep, David Graham, two-time major winner, and who most younger Australians wouldn't know, and many don't appreciate. And Phil Anderson, who trailblazed for Aussie cyclists overseas. That one's got a big asterisk on it for me, but he is an unknown champion. Stuart O'Grady's another cyclist who might slide in there. What do you reckon?
Yeah, Robbie McEwen. For me, Robbie McEwen has won the points at the Tour de France three times.
Yeah.
Three times. Like, that is just insane. So a silver medal at the World Championships is the best that he's got representing Australia. But, 2002, he was the first Australian to win the points classification. And then he won it again in 2004 and again in 2006. Beating Australians Baden Cook and Stuart O'Grady. So, the green jacket three times, green jersey three times, very, very impressive. I've got a couple that I'll quickly...
I was going to ask. Back to you.
Steph Gilmore. So, for a seven-time world champion, Lane Beachley is probably the most well-known Australian female surfer, and Mick Fannin would probably be the most well-known Australian male surfer. But Steph Gilmore, she won four in a row, 07, 08, 09, 10, and then won 2012, 2014, 2018.
Wow.
So, she started professionally at 17.
I remember she won a world championship after... some freak who was high on drugs assaulted her outside her apartment on the Gold Coast. And she had to take time off. Man, geez, the random things that are stuck in my head. And then she came back and won the World Championship after that. Man.
Yeah.
She's a gun. Who's your other one?
Phenomenal. So, cricket, Damien Martin. A lot of people Damien Martin for going out against South Africa in the game that Australia lost and his dismissal in his last match.
Or we just think of him as we think of him as a good cover drive and not much else.
Yeah. He averaged 46 in tests over 67 test matches. He averaged 40 in one dayers over 208 one-day matches. He was one of the most beautiful batsmen to watch.
Oh, he's a glorious bat,
Everyone just remembers that he got dropped because he apparently lost the game against South Africa when he was actually the only one that made any runs.
Yeah.
But Mark Bradkey.
Oh,
You think of the Melbourne Tigers championship teams and you go Gaze and Copeland.
Brett Rainbow in the dunk comps.
Of course.
I don't think he played a minute on the court, but
Mark Bradkey, he did go over he was on the Philly 76ers list. I'm not sure if he played, but he's a phenomenal basketballer. And now one last one for me. this might be controversial, but this is someone who, in the over time, his achievements have sort of been forgotten. Greg Norman.
Yeah.
Greg Norman, because he only won two majors. He won the Open in 1986 and 1993. However, he was the runner-up eight times and he got 30 top 10 finishes in his career. He was number one in the world for something ridiculous like 300 weeks in a row.
That's right. Yeah, people forget that he was number one for so long, don't they?
Yeah. He was brilliant. And the reason is because of all of those top 10 finishes.
Yeah.
Wow. 30 of them. So Greg Norman, it might sound like a weird one because he has been so successful, but he's also someone who everyone just forgets how brilliant he actually was.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I love watching him play. He was just amazing.
Yeah.
Absolutely amazing.
Well, so I don't watch golf, as you know, but I know that he was really, really good.
So in the four majors, two wins, 8 seconds, four thirds, six more times, either fourth or fifth, and 30 times in total in the top 10.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's a third of the events that he played in. He finished in the top 10.
God.
Yep.
All right.
So they're
the shark, the great white shark, and he's all of those top 10 finishes made him an incredibly rich, rich man.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And all of his different, I think he's got a jerky company or something.
I would hope so.
He's got a lot.
Looks great in the nude too.
For a 60-odd-year-old bloke,
I'd love to look like that. Anyway, one last one, yeah. Andrew.
So Greg Norman signature Wagyu beef jerky.
Of course.
Yeah, I'm going to buy some of that.
Yeah, let's see if he'll sponsor
it. We'll try it for one of the podcasts.
Let's hit him up for a sponsorship, see what happens. What's the word? All he can say is no.
Yeah, a sporting discussion proudly brought to you by Greg Norman's signature Wagyu beef jerky. Wrap your laughing gear around some shark.
That's great. We can do some great life reads around that. But anyway, we're running out of time. We're over time. So I'll do my last one. And then we'll wrap it up because thanks to everyone. Right. Thanks to everyone who got in touch at ASD_radio on Twitter or facebook.com/thesportingdiscussion. Last couple of shows, we've been absolutely pumped with people sending us their thoughts and ideas and suggestions and that. So we weren't able to get to all of them. So get to the Facebook page or the Twitter pages to see all of the suggestions that people came through and to give one of your own. Now, my last one, Andrew, is I don't even know if it's – well, to me it's not controversial, but – people might refer to it as controversial. Now, I'll just read you some stats and you tell me if you think you know who this is. This person is only one of three players to have completed what's called the boxed set in tennis, and that is single, double and mixed titles at all four majors.
Oh, wow.
64 major titles in singles, doubles and mixed doubles.
That's a lot of titles.
Yes. What is it?
And we're talking underappreciated.
Yeah. This one will probably give it away. 29 Grand Slam finals for 24 titles and 5 runner-up.
Crikey.
33 Grand Slam women's finals for 19 wins. 19 Grand Slam doubles championships.
I'll let you keep going, but I've got it.
25 mixed double Grand Slam finals for 21 mixed double Grand Slam championships.
Yep.
Where's the other one? Here's the big one here.
It's a pretty impressive resume. It's a pretty impressive resume thus far.
It's an absolutely incredible resume. 192 singles titles before and after the Open era, which is an all-time record that is not going to be anyone come near to. Career singles win-loss record was 1,177 wins versus 106 losses on all surfaces, hard, clay, grass and carpet as well, because this is back in the day. It's an all-time thing. That's won at least 100 singles matches in 6 years of this person's career. Won more than 80% of her singles matches against top 10 players. That's a 297 wins versus 73 losses record against top 10 players. Year-end top-ranked player in the world 7 times. Now, you know who it is?
I do know who it is.
It is Margaret Court.
Yes.
Who has
a phenomenal record.
Absolutely phenomenal record at tennis.
And the thing is, even if you knew that Margaret Court had the most Grand Slam titles, it still doesn't quite, well, it doesn't come close to recognising what she has achieved. What did you say, 192 singles titles?
Mm.
Yeah.
Not even, no one's getting close to it, to that. We've seen, I mean, you know my thoughts on Serena Williams. In my eyes, Serena Williams, one of, if not the greatest athletes of all time. Mm. She's stuck on 23 Grand Slam titles, and it doesn't look like, you know, touch wood, I hope she changes, but it doesn't look like she's going to get to 24. So it just shows how hard it is. And Serena Williams has been around for decades.
And also Serena, now I'm gonna get this wrong, but I think that she's lost her last four finals that she's been in.
Yeah, that's right.
Which just shows you how difficult it is. Mm. Yeah. So she's lost her last four finals.
But so, it seems that Margaret Court, unappreciated is an interesting word to use for the Margaret Court situation, because she's...
Margaret Court as a tennis player.
As a tennis player, most unappreciated. A lot of people find it difficult to reconcile her tennis career with her views as a Pentecostal minister. She has some pretty controversial, to say the least, views on homosexuality, same-sex marriage, traditional living and all that sort of stuff.
I'm not going to go into support her on any of those.
No one is.
As a tennis player.
Yeah. When the debate about, you know, remove her name from the stadium in Melbourne comes up, on a tennis standard, you can't do it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, there is the other.
The other stuff kind of outweighs all of that, yeah.
Tennis phenomenon.
This is a sporting discussion, not a religious discussion.
Very quickly, though, you talk. I'm gonna throw another one at you, and this is definitely unappreciated, and I'm gonna not underappreciated, but unappreciated. The Australian female tennis player who was being the top ranked Australian singles player at one stage for 452 consecutive weeks, 38 titles on the WTA Tour, 9 in singles, 26 in doubles, including a US Open victory in 2011 and a French Open runner-up in 2010.
Mm.
Sam Stosur,
no regard.
Zero regard, zero. She's made the finals of all.
People joke about her
in the doubles.
People joke about Sam Stosur. They've got no respect for the career she managed to build.
Yeah. she's been amazing. She was a former world number 4 in singles, world number 1 in doubles, world number 1 in mixed doubles. It's just brilliant career for Sam.
I think it's good to get that out there. I think I'll include that in the write up.
Have you got any more that you were going to go to?
No, I'm about to wrap up. How many more have you got?
No, I don't have any more, but I'm going to rattle through the news that we haven't got to that we might talk about next week.
Okay.
Sun Yang has been abandoned by his Chinese fans, with some Chinese fans even apologising to Mac Horton. Lance Armstrong has admitted that he started doping at age 21. And Steve Waugh had one of the best responses to Shane Warne, suggesting that for there to be a feud, it needs to be two-way.
Yeah, I like that. So, we'll talk about that next week. That's got nothing to do with what we're talking about now.
Sun Yang and Lance Armstrong, two massive bits of news that came out in the last couple of days.
That Lance Armstrong one's going to be huge. Apparently it's in a documentary, a Last Dance-style documentary coming on ESPN. But We're not worried about that right now. We are going to wrap it up. Andrew, are you appearing on any radio next week?
Yes, Triple R in Melbourne, 102.7 on your dial or Triple R website is...
We will link to it in the show notes.
Yes, or download the app and you can get that on demand, triplerr.org.au, 7:15 Monday morning. Hopefully there'll be a little bit more sport. There was a bit more last week, and we might get some more live sport to talk about this week. AJ?
Might actually have some fixtures for AFL and NRL. But anyway, yes, I'll be on ABC Central Victoria at 9:15 a.m. with Fiona Parker in the mornings, and got something coming for the Raw this week as well about the NRL and the referee situation, which we can talk about next week as well.
Yes, I saw an article just before that it isn't going away, this issue. So
no,
it isn't. Interested to follow that up.
Plenty more to come from that, so keep an eye on the raw.com for my column. Do not forget to visit sportingdiscussion.com.au, your new home of sports of all sorts, your new sleek-looking home of sports of all sorts. We've done a little bit of work to it, and there's still some work going on, but more articles are coming up. We're going to write up this article, this show. We're going to write up a couple of other things. We've got a few great writers doing things for us that we're going to put through over the next few weeks. And if you want to suggest something for the website or for the show, or you want to write something, get in touch at ASD_radio on the Twitter, facebook.com/asportingdiscussion, or get involved on asportingdiscussion.com.au.
Yes, we saw Chris Meister put up an article. It was, "Has innovation really improved sport?" So after watching some old sporting contests, comparing that to the modern day, so that that got quite a bit of traction on socials this week, which was great to see. And if anyone knows how to set up a bracket system, let me know, because I've got the top 64 fast bowlers of all time ready to go, and I just need them to get put into some sort of workable bracket.
We'll have a look at that. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next week.
Peace out.